of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico suffered life-threatening injuries when he was shot in an attempted assassination on Wednesday. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino reports.
Fico was in the central town of Hanlova for a government meeting and was shaking hands with a crowd of people when a man near a barricade pulled out a gun and fired. Slovak media said the shooter was a 71-year-old man, though the motive was initially unclear. The country's interior minister said it was, quote, politically motivated. The 59-year-old was rushed to a local hospital and then transported by helicopter to a regional capital for urgent treatment. Slovakia's president Zuzana Čaputová said she was shocked by the shooting, saying it was, quote, an attack on democracy.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday told Chinese media he is prepared to negotiate an end to the Ukraine conflict on the eve of his visit to China. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The official Xinhua news agency quotes Putin saying, "We're open to a dialogue, but such negotiations must take into account the interests of all countries involved in the conflict, including ours." Putin adds, "Moscow is seeking a comprehensive, sustainable and just settlement of this conflict through peaceful means." His trip comes as Russian forces have pressed their offensive in northeast Ukraine's Kharkiv region. China claims to take a neutral position in the conflict, but has backed Moscow in real terms. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday fended off criticism he is not planning for a post-war reality in the Gaza Strip, saying it's impossible to prepare for any scenario in the Palestinian enclave until it can defeat Hamas. This is VOA News. Netanyahu has faced increasing pressure from critics at home and allies abroad, especially the United States, to present a post-war plan for Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians on Wednesday marked the 76th anniversary of the mass expulsion from what is now Israel in the war surrounding the country's creation in 1948. In an interview with the Associated Press, Palestinian refugee Dawood Assad said a trench near his home was helpful when he and his Palestinian refugees needed to flee Israeli forces during what is known as the Nakba.
So when the Zionists attacked us on April 1948, we happened to have like a trench on the road, and that trench saved actually a lot of people, gave them a chance to escape from the west side of the village.
Nakba is the Arabic word for a catastrophe. Some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced to flee from what is now Israel. More than twice that number have been displaced within Gaza since the start of the Israel-Hamas war, which was triggered when militants from Gaza attacked Israel on October 7th. Doctors in Gaza said on Wednesday they are struggling to provide medical treatment, and many patients can't leave for treatment abroad because the southern Rafah crossing is closed. Here's Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder.
Gaza's medical system has virtually collapsed, witnesses say. Egypt blames the closure on Israeli military operations around Rafah. Israel, which seized control of the crossing last week, said on Tuesday it was up to Egypt to reopen it. Remarks described by Cairo as desperate attempts to shift the blame, as well as shutting down a vital evacuation route for patients in Gaza. The shutdown has left desperately needed foreign aid piling up on the Egyptian side of the border.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. U.S. security officials said that foreign adversaries will once again seek to influence the upcoming U.S. elections during a congressional hearing Wednesday. AP's Lisa Dwyer reports.
It is now easier and cheaper than ever to create lifelike images, video, and audio that can fool even the most discerning voter. Other tools of disinformation include state media, online influencers, and networks of fake accounts that can quickly amplify false and misleading content. Russia, China, and Iran remain the main actors looking to interfere with the upcoming election. During the hearing, top security officials did say that the U.S. has greatly improved its ability to safeguard election security and to identify and combat foreign disinformation campaigns. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Follow us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at VOAnews.com, as well as on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and X, formerly known as Twitter, and download our VOA News app. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 16th. Here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan President William Ruto may not address the joint session of Congress when he comes to Washington later this month.
It's an election year, so anything that Speaker Johnson would do to present the Biden administration in a positive light could potentially garner backlash from the Republican establishment.
A new study exposes gender bias in African family law. Nigerian officials probe a plan to marry off scores of female orphans. Prolonged power cuts in Guinea-Conakry make life difficult for businesses and workers. A $2.2 billion pledge for clean cooking in Africa. Benin and Niger resolve a diplomatic squabble over crude oil shipments.
All of them are in violation of ECOWAS protocol. As soon as the sanction was lifted against Niger, Niger was really supposed to reopen his border and to accept goods coming from the port of Cotonou.
And President Biden and former President Trump appear to agree to a June presidential election debate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The decision by U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson not to invite Kenyan President William Ruto to a joint meeting of Congress when he comes to Washington later this month has disappointed many people. VOA's Kara Van Dam has more from Washington.
Kenya is a key U.S. ally in Africa and is seen as a bulwark in heading off Russia's influence in eastern Africa. Many in Washington were hoping to see Ruto invited to speak before a joint meeting of Congress when he arrives in Washington on May 23rd for a state visit, marking the 60th anniversary of U.S.-Kenyan diplomatic relations. Republican Michael McCaul, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, urged House Speaker Mike Johnson to extend the invitation to Ruto. He and Democrat Gregory Meeks wrote, "It would underscore the importance of the U.S.-Kenya relationship and send a valuable signal to the people of Africa." Raj Shah, Speaker Johnson's chief of staff, said it mostly boiled down to a scheduling conflict. He told VOA that, quote, "It is really an issue of floor time and not intended to be in any way a slight to Kenya as a U.S. ally." David Monda, a Kenyan and professor of political science at City University of New York, told VOA that he thinks Johnson's decision had more to do with appealing to the right wing of his party.
Mike Johnson, the speaker, is really attempting to show the right wing members of his coalition, particularly the Freedom Caucus, that he's not going to give in to all the Democratic requests. And I think President Ruto's trip falls squarely within this space, whereby Johnson recently survived a motion to vacate, and he's really trying to placate the very angry members of his party.
Joanna LeBlanc, a lawyer and partner at the Washington, D.C. firm Adami Advisory Group, calls it a missed opportunity to strengthen U.S.-Kenyan ties, adding it's been over a decade since an African head of state addressed Congress.
I can understand from a political standpoint why Speaker Johnson would not approve this. Let's be honest, it's an election year, and it's one that has proven itself to be very contentious between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. So anything that Speaker Johnson would do to present the Biden administration in a positive light could potentially garner backlash from the Republican establishment.
LeBlanc says Kenya's assistance has been critical in addressing security in East Africa and beyond.
Kenya's support and partnership in the African Union transition mission in Somalia is also critical to the stability in the region. We also have Kenya's partnership with the U.S. encountering al-Shabaab, an Islamic militant group based in Somalia. And now you have Kenya, who has taken the global stage, supporting the United States in addressing the insecurity crisis taking place currently in the Republic of Haiti, a country located in the Caribbean.
Shaw says not inviting Ruto was more a consequence of the congressional schedule. He also noted that Johnson has offered the Kenyan embassy over 90 minutes of engagement, including a one-on-one visit with Johnson and a bipartisan leadership meeting with committee chairs and ranking members. Joint meetings require a considerable amount of planning on Capitol Hill. The chamber is shut down for hours, and such an event entails a major security operation. In addition, Ruto arrives on a Thursday, just ahead of the U.S. Memorial Day holiday. Members of Congress typically are not in Washington on Fridays and generally return to their home districts for several days around national holidays. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
A diplomatic squabble between Benin and Niger appears to have ended, at least for now. This after Benin decided Wednesday to allow crude oil from Niger to ship through ports in Benin. Reuters reported Wednesday that Benin blocked exports from landlocked Niger and demanded the country reopen its border to goods from Benin. Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Akan tells me both countries are in violation of Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS's protocols.
When ECOWAS decided to lift the sanction against Niger, Niger accepted to reopen its borders with Nigeria, but refused to reopen his border with Benin. And we all know that the port of Cotonou, part of its activities is related to the transportation of goods from the port to Niger. So the fact that Niger refused to reopen his border with Benin was a kind of sanction against Niger, in the sense that they didn't want Niger to continue to have activities in his port. So now that they decided to start using Benin for the exportation of their oil, Benin also remember that few weeks before, Niger refused to give them that possibility of exporting to Niger, so that they are retaliating. And the president of Benin, in an interview, made it clear that it was a kind of retaliation.
So who does this seek to benefit the most? And wouldn't any further action violate ECOWAS protocols?
Yeah, all of them are in violation of ECOWAS protocols. As soon as the sanction was lifted against Niger, Niger was really supposed to reopen his border and to accept goods coming from the port of Cotonou. Benin also signed agreement to allow Niger to export its oil through its own territory. That contract needs also to be respected. But here, the problem is Benin needs money from the transportation of goods to Niger. Niger needs money for selling its oil. So I think the only option that they have is to reach an agreement for each of them getting a kind of benefit.
So as you said, ECOWAS lifted sanctions against Niger because of the overthrow of President Bazoum. What did ECOWAS get back in return after lifting the sanctions against Niger?
So far, nothing. And I think the lifting of the sanction was just a kind of push for Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali to reconsider their decision of leaving the organization. So I think for that one, it's another cycle of conversation and discussion. You heard that the new Senegalese prime minister has decided to organize a tour in the three countries to discuss with the leaders so that they can reconsider coming back to ECOWAS. And I know there are many other actors who are trying also to do their best to convince the leader of the three countries.
Ibrahim Akan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. In Guinea-Conakry, prolonged power cuts in the capital are making life difficult for businesses and workers across the country. The situation has caused many private enterprises to either shut down completely or lay off dozens of its workers, provoking acute financial constraints. Other enterprises have decided no longer use power generators because of high fuel costs, which they say are impacting their businesses. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
Entrepreneur Abdul Karim Sani says the cost of fuel per day to run his enterprise is too high and is beginning to seriously impact his business.
We've been in this power outages for quite a long period of time now. As a result, we've had to undergo a lot of losses. especially in the area of our businesses. As I'm speaking to you, I was forced to have an electrogen, which is consuming not less than 600,000 franc guinea every day in terms of its consumption.
Sani says he cannot continue to accept these expenses just to afford electricity, as the current climate does not favor business and investment in Guinea. Tailors in Conakry are also badly affected by the power cuts. A popular designer, Mukhtar Ba, uses a power generator to do his work to satisfy his clients. But he says he ends up spending more than what he earns a day.
On dépense 7 litres par jour, ça, ça me coûte cher. On fait le travail pour satisfaire le client, juste pour ça, sinon on n'a rien dedans.
He says business people are paying 7 litres of petrol a day, which is a lot, and not earning a profit. They are asking the government for a permanent electricity supply. People are suffering and beg for reduction in prices. Also affected by the power cut are housewives, who used to store food in their freezers for several days. But they say today they throw away a lot of food that has spoiled due to lack of electricity. Fatimata Kuruma is one of the housewives who blame the junta for their current predicament.
Avant, on gardait nos manger dans le congélateur pour plusieurs jours.
She says before now she used to cook and stock food in the freezer for days, but now that is not the case, because every day she had to dump food in the trash. Residents in Conakry have electricity starting around 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. In some areas of Conakry, there may be a power outages for up to 2 days. This affects not only tailors, but welders, barbers, and private radio and television stations who use expensive power generators. The Guinean government has failed to reach an agreement with a Turkish ship that supplies electricity to Conakry. According to the Prime Minister, the ship charges between $900 to $500,000 a month. Power shortages are leading to sporadic demonstrations by angry youth, which sometimes turn bloody and fatal in Conakry and its environs. In the meantime, the Prime Minister Bahouri has announced that his government has signed a deal with neighboring Senegal to supply Guinea and its environs. Guineans, especially residents in Conakry, are keen to know the cost of the deal and whether Conakry and its environs will once again have a 24-hour electricity supply, which they had before they were through. A former president, Alpha Condé NGO, says they will compel the authorities to reveal the details of the deal. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 16th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Women Affairs says it is investigating a plan by a lawmaker in central Niger State to marry off some 100 female orphans of unknown age on May 24. Abdul Malik Saki Daji announced the wedding plan last week, but has now called it off following widespread outrage. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian Minister of Women Affairs Uju Kennedy Ohanenye spoke to journalists in Abuja Tuesday condemning the move by the lawmaker. Uju said she had petitioned the police and filed a suit in court to stop the marriage plans pending a thorough investigation to ascertain the age of the orphans and whether they consented to the marriages.
This is totally unacceptable by Federal Minister of Women Affairs and by the government. I have written in a letter, I've written a petition to the police, and I have filed a case of for injunction to stop him until such a time a thorough investigation is carried out on those girls, find out whether they gave their consent, find out their ages, find out the people marrying them, who are they.
Last week, Speaker of the Niger State Assembly, Abdul Malik Sarkin Daji, announced his support for the mass wedding of some 100 orphans whose relatives were killed during attacks by armed bandits. He said it was part of his support to his constituents following a wedding funding appeal by local traditional and religious leaders in the area. The mass wedding had been slated for May 24th, but on Tuesday, Sarkin Daji annulled the plans following criticism from state officials.
That support I intend to give, I'm withdrawing it. For the marriage of those orphans, I'm withdrawn. The parents can have the support. If they wish, let them go ahead and marry them out.
As it is right now, I'm not threatened by the action of the minister.
Despite national laws prohibiting it, forced or arranged marriage is a common phenomenon in Nigeria, especially among rural communities in the predominantly Muslim north, where religious and cultural norms like polygamy favor the practice. Poor families often use forced marriage as a means to ease financial pressure, and the European Union Agency for Asylum says girls who refuse could face repercussions such as neglect, ostracism, physical assault, and even rape. 30% of girls in Nigeria are married before they turn 18, according to Girls Not Brides, a global network of more than 1,400 civil society groups working to end child marriage. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A new report finds that gaps in family laws in most African countries are fueling discrimination against women and girls. The report from the international NGO Equality Now says laws that favor men in matters of sex, marriage, and inheritance, among other issues, leave many women in despair. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
The study released to coincide with the United Nations declared International Day of the Family on Wednesday highlights how legal frameworks and customary practices in 20 African countries have fueled discrimination in marriage, divorce, custody, and property rights. Esther Waweru is a senior legal advisor at Equality Now and co-author of the report. She spoke with VOA from Kenya on how gaps in family laws have affected the lives of women in Africa.
So take a case of Sudan, for instance, where women cannot initiate divorce, unlike men. So it therefore means that a woman would be trapped in a marriage that they want to leave just because they cannot initiate divorce.
Waweru says in some countries where women initiate a divorce, they are not allowed to take custody of the children from a previous marriage when they remarry. In Malawi, the report notes that courts have ruled rape does not extend to marriage. It says customary law in Malawi presumes perpetual consent to sex within marriage and that a wife can deny her husband sex only when she is sick or legally separated. While in Tanzania, the report says marital rape is only criminalized upon separation. It also says customary and religious laws in countries like Algeria, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria undermine women and girls in matters of inheritance as they receive less than men and boys. Hara Akarib is the executive director for Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She told VOA from Ethiopia that the legal imbalance in many African countries leaves women feeling helpless.
Imagine, you know, that you are not treated equally or discriminated against. It goes without say. You are typically poor. You are exposed to violence systematically. You're dehumanized and undermined. You don't have equal access to opportunities. You're subjected to different forms of sexual violence, and your dignity is compromised.
Waweru of Equality Now says although many countries have ratified key international treaties that protect women's rights, existing domestic laws make implementation and enforcement of these treaties difficult. She calls upon African states to fully align their family laws and their practices within international human rights standards. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
World leaders on Tuesday this week pledged $2.2 billion for clean cooking in Africa. The International Energy Agency said it convened global leaders for the Clean Cooking Summit in Paris to make 2024 a turning point for progress. According to the agency, in rural areas, Africans are using traditional cooking methods which are harmful for health. VOA's Douglas Mpoga reached Jackson Kumbori, a senior circular economy and climate change coordinator at Kenya Private Sector Alliance, also known as KEPSA, to find out the importance of clean cooking in Africa.
Clean cooking is a bigger problem in Africa due to several factors. Firstly, traditional cooking methods such as open fires and inefficient stoves are still widely used, leading to high levels of indoor air pollution and associated health risks, particularly for women and children who are often responsible for cooking. In addition, the reliance on biomass fuels like wood and charcoal contributes to deforestation, environmental degradation, and climate change. And not forgetting that limited access to clean cooking technologies and fuels exacerbates these challenges, obviously perpetuating a cycle of poverty and inequality.
So what impact, if any, do you think this pledge of $2.2 billion will have on the continent?
The pledge of $2.2 billion by world leaders at the Paris summit to combat the clean cooking crisis in Africa is significant and has the potential to have a transformative impact. Obviously, this funding can be allocated towards initiatives aimed at increasing access to clean cooking technologies and fuels, such as distributing clean cooking stoves, promoting renewable energy solutions, and providing education and awareness programs. Not forgetting that the investment can support research and development efforts to innovate new technologies and business models tailored to the needs of African communities. Eventually, this financial commitment will lead, or it actually shows and cements and demonstrates a collective recognition of the urgency and importance of addressing the clean cooking crisis, and will have an impact in catalyzing the momentum towards achieving universal access to clean cooking in Africa.
International help aside, what role do you think African governments and local NGOs can play in solving this problem?
While the pledge for the $2.2 billion is a positive step towards addressing the clean cooking crisis in Africa, there are still challenges that we as Africa see and we need them to be addressed, particularly in the context of rural electrification. While clean cooking solutions play a crucial role in obviously improving health, reducing poverty, and mitigating climate change, they are just one part of the broader energy access landscape. So obviously, rural electrification initiatives are essential for providing reliable and sustainable energy access.
Jackson Kumbori is a senior circular economy and climate change coordinator at Kenya Private Sector Alliance. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi. U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump traded barbs online Wednesday while agreeing to debate each other in person at least twice prior to November's general election rematch. Details from viewers. Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
CNN reports the Democratic Party incumbent and the Republican challenger are scheduled to debate on June 27th, while ABC says a second Trump-Biden debate will be held on September 10th. The announcements came within hours of the president and his predecessor taunting each other about debates. Biden, in a video posted to social media platforms, said Trump lost two debates to him in 2020 and is now acting like he wants to meet again.
Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Trump currently does not have to be in court in New York City on Wednesdays during his criminal hush money trial. That trial is likely to conclude before next month's first scheduled debate. Trump on his Truth Social platform responded he's ready and willing to debate and wants more encounters than the June and September dates. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
And And that's it for this Thursday, May 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty, Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe, whatever you do.
Obtaining your college degree is a great achievement. However, your next step, that of finding a job, can be daunting. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore how new graduates can get ready for the workforce and discuss the need for soft skills to help boost their chances of employment. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 9.